This session, titled Living Disgracefully, is a conversation featuring Susan Johnson, Jacinta Parsons, and Tracy Spicer.
Welcome to our next session. I'd like to begin by thanking the sponsors of this session, Honey Bee Homes. You would have found some nice treats on your seats, postcards and a wildflower mix, so they'll be lovely to take home. Thank you, sponsors. Join me in welcoming the guests for our next session.
Hello, and a very, very warm welcome. It's lovely to be on Bundjalung Country once again on this beautiful day. And I see so many elders in the room today, right? Second and third wave feminists, we stand on the shoulders of giants. So how about giving yourselves a round of applause for coming out to this session today? This session is called, quite evocatively, Living Disgracefully. Older women know that our society, smitten with youthfulness, devalues them in ways that can diminish their self-worth. Two thoughtful authors discuss ways to reclaim pride in one's aging self, including by living disgracefully. And I'm so honoured to be introducing these authors to you. Jacinta Parsons is a broadcaster, writer and public speaker who's been hosting the afternoon program on ABC Local Radio Melbourne. She has just released her second book, The Magnificent, A Question of Age, Women, Ageing and the Forever Self. Please welcome Jacinta. Susan Johnson's Aphrodite's Breath exposes the struggles and joys of moving to a Greek island with her 85-year-old mother, Barbara, without a word of Greek. And it is also a ripping read. Please welcome Susan Johnson.
Thank you.
I loved both of your books, and they had a really ethereal quality about them. They took us on a journey in different ways. Would you mind reading an excerpt from each of them? Susan, you can go first if you like.
Okay. I'll read about arriving at the house with my mother. I had looked very, very carefully on the net, researched as well as I could, because Mum was 85, as Tracy's just said, and she was a very independent 85-year-old and still driving, no illnesses, pretty good health, still smoking, fagging away at 85. And so she was buying Greek cigarettes, but she didn't want to drive. And I'd chosen this house because I thought it would be near a cafe and it was quite comfortable for her, but she didn't like it at all, and that was the first sign of things to come. So I loved the house as soon as I opened the Greek blue wooden gate in the stone wall surrounding it and ran up the stone stairs in the garden and through the front door. My mother did not. I had carefully examined each online photograph of every room in the house. It had polished grey cement floors, whitewashed walls, and handsome windows looking across to the village. Upstairs, a large room led out onto a roof terrace with a spectacular view. There was an ensuite toilet and sink, plus a little room containing a shower, decorated in the Catherian style, with plain cement-rendered walls and no fancy tiles. The bedroom had a traditional vaulted Greek ceiling of unpainted wooden beams, graceful and domed like that of a church. There was a bedroom on the ground level with a bathroom just off it. I thought we'd agreed in advance that this would be the best bedroom for Mum, meaning she wouldn't have to go up and down the stairs. The room had a double bunk and also a fold-out futon couch, which could be set up as a fixed double bed. But to Mum, everything was wrong. She thought the ensuite bathroom wasn't a bathroom at all. It probably was the same size as most separate toilets, but with a shower fixture on one wall and no defined recess, so that it was essentially a wet room with a drain in the centre of the polished cement floor. This whole room will get flooded. I won't be able to use the toilet, she said. Besides, she added, the futon in the bedroom next to the supposed bathroom was too low for her to easily get in and out. She didn't rate the kitchen taps either, because of how far she had to reach. They didn't think about short people. or the laundry, or the washing machine. The laundry was behind a folding door, not so much a room as a cupboard, and she had never seen a washing machine with a barrel you had to close with a latch. They're common in France, I said. She was not impressed. That latch is going to take my finger off. Out the front of the house, there was a garden and a pergola strung with a grapevine, not yet in fruit. There was a square of raised earth at one side of the courtyard, crowned with an identifiable dead plant. Immediately, I imagine a garden of oregano, basil, sage, and perhaps something flowering and pretty. Do you really want the upstairs bathroom? I asked Mum when we went back inside. What about the stairs? I'm not sleeping in there, she said, marching past the ground level bedroom in the direction of the stairs. They were in the traditional Greek style, meaning they were solid cement without handrails. Mum would have to keep her balancing hand on the wall and be especially careful of the twist at the top, where the stairs opened up into the bedroom. Mum was 85. Have I mentioned that? Have I mentioned my mother was not by any means the type to be pushed about, much less instructed? If I have given the impression I was concerned for her welfare because she was a timid, pleasing sort, let me correct that. When my dad was at home, slowly dying, my brother Steve and I took turns to care for him so Mum could have a break. One night, she walked out of Dad's room in a huff about something. "Geez, she's going to be a handful when you're gone," Steve said to Dad. Dad laughed. "Oh, she won't. She'll be fine." I would later come to reconsider this conversation.
Thank you. Oh, Susan, what a wonderful passage to choose, because it really paints a picture of Barbara, your mother.
Yeah.
And it also tells you all how evocative and funny and beautiful Susan's writing is, with a real sense of place. Jacinta, would you like to do a reading now?
I would. I was not prepared for this, and I need to say thank you to Sarah, who went and bought my book for me at a very reasonable price. So thank you very much. Lovely to be here. I didn't know whether to start at the beginning or at the end, and I think I'll begin at the end in the reading. It's called The Ether, New Beginnings. I realise as I come to an end that there is no neat ending to the question of age. I am not new. I am the continuation of a certain kind of story, a story that has been on an eternal loop. I've been subjected to the same fate as women before me, to be lost on this earth and then to be found again, but different, changed. I am the girl who walked to the shops. She is me. This oldness that I am embarking upon is happening to that very same little girl. She is not gone. She is flowing through my blood. And each time I imagine her as someone else, something different, trapped in a photograph taken long ago and now stuck in a book, I lose the compass that I need to guide me through this. In the very same way, every time I imagine that I am not the woman who lived thousands of years before me or who we are yet to be born, I am lost. We are eternal. We are interchangeable. What is the absolute elemental pure truth of this experience, this aging process? How can we understand it so that we can understand ourselves properly, not necessarily in line with what the world wants from us? After all, surely by now we know we cannot trust the world. In the process of thinking about age, I have started to face the pain of what it has meant to live as a woman. The understanding that I'm connected to the women that have existed well before me, the ones who were burnt and tortured and raped and hurt, and the ones who were loved and nurtured and that loved themselves. We are born and we die on an eternal loop. The world we are born in and live has not changed, not really. It still seeks to kill us if we do not comply. Just a really light moment of reflection. Unfortunately, no comedy.
That was an excellent choice as an excerpt because Jacinta's book really does take you through time and what it means to be a girl, to be a woman, to be an aging woman and to be an elder. It's very wise, it's incredibly deep, and I must admit I've cried probably two or three times while reading it because so many of us have, I'm about to cry now, have shared experiences throughout our lifetimes, and we'll talk about that soon. Susan, why did you decide to write this book at this time?
Complicated reasons. All books have complicated beginnings, but a whole series of events coalesced all at the same time. I used to be a journalist. I've supported myself through journalism a lot during my lifetime. I'm sure many of you know that Australian authors on average earn about $13,000 a year. That's the latest figures from the ASA. So I've always had to support myself through journalism. And I was also a single mother supporting my two sons. So I'd gone back to journalism. But everyone also knows that journalism is dying, especially hard print newspapers. So I was working for Murdoch, and Murdoch was offering redundancies. So I was thinking, weighing up whether I might take one. And then a couple of things happened. Both my sons, we lived in London for 10 years, and both my sons returned to London. So I was suddenly an empty nester. My children are very close in age. They're only 15 months apart. And they were both gone like that. And then I also had a terrible boss, who I wasn't very fond of. And I used to hate going to work every day by then. And I went to visit a friend who has two sisters who live on a farm in a beautiful granite area of Queensland. And they had both given up their jobs to live a better life, a more economically deprived life, but they wanted to be free. And as I was visiting them and walking across, I thought, you know, that would be wonderful. How can I do this? And I was thinking all these ways. I knew another friend of mine had moved to Greece to live cheaply. I had a long connection with Greece, and we might talk about that as we go along. But I suddenly thought, if I could really survive, if I was living in Greece, I could eke out that redundancy and survive for a long time. The problem was I was the main carer for my mother. I'm the oldest child. I'm the only girl. I have two younger brothers. And I had become the unofficial carer for mum, even though, as I've said, she's very independent. So I thought, well, I can't leave mum. I just can't. I was ringing her every day. So just on a whim, I said, you know, mum, I've got this mad idea of going to Greece. You know, would you consider coming too? And she said, yes. Straight away. So that's how it happened.
Isn't that wonderful? I've got a friend who's recently done that with her 93-year-old mother. And they're in the Northern Hemisphere at the moment, travelling around. She's still very active, actually, her beautiful mother. But it is hard. It brings with it its challenges, doesn't it? Because of the nature of ageing. Jacinta, what made you decide to write a book about ageing now? I know some people have said to you, oh, but you're not old enough to write a book about ageing.
I've really had to show my credentials of ageing. What would you know about this? So I will say right up the front, I know nothing. This is called A Question of Age because there's lots of questions. But there was a really clear moment when the interest in writing this book became really clear. I was at a bar and I was chatting to a woman there, and we were having one of those conversations that you can have with a stranger that is just like, oh, yes, I totally know you, you know me. How wonderful that we share this simpatico view of the world. We were grabbing, and I was like, isn't this great that you can meet somebody and really get to understand them and they understand you? And then she turned to me and she said words that shuddered through my body. She said, oh, my goodness, I wish you were my mum. And then I did the maths and I thought, well, yeah, I could be your mother, yes. I would actually really like to be your mother. I didn't know this was the kind of relationship perhaps that you saw of me. And then, I mean, obviously that starts off in this kind of joyful way of recognising that the world outside you doesn't actually recognise how you feel on the inside. And that disparity between the out and the in was where I began to really wonder about how are we made old in this world around us, as opposed to when we close our eyes and we imagine how we feel inside. She's a very different girl than the mother of a woman at a bloody bar.
It's an awful shock sometimes, isn't it, when you catch your reflection in a mirror or someone says that, because, I mean, I don't know about all of you, I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way. I still feel 17 inside some days and try to make my body do things that I really shouldn't be doing, right? But it's hard to feel what you should be doing and how should I feel at this age? Mm. That's what your book really, that's where it really struck a chord with me. Susan, you start your book by evoking the Odyssey and dear Penelope sitting at home with her loom while Odysseus travels the world. And you said that by going to Greece that you were walking in the footsteps of men, because historically mostly men have been the ones who traversed the world. Were you drawn to the land of the immortal gods because you were 62 and your mother was 85 when you went there? Were you trying to grasp some kind of immortality?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. But probably, yes, I think there's something about Greece that speaks to me very deeply. I first went there as a young woman, and there's certainly part of me that was trying to recapture that complete wild freedom that you have when you're young, that you're not supposed to have anymore when you're older. And in many ways, when you become a carer of children, and then I had become a carer of my mother in a way, women's lives are quite often about duty and care. I was on another panel yesterday talking about these very questions, and women in this world do a wonderful job of that. We know that we hold up the world in many ways. But there's very little room in the lives of most women for that jumping off and choosing another direction in life where you're going to do the unexpected. And so many people said to me, I wouldn't do it at my age at 62, and I'm the oldest on this panel, I'm 66, so I'm going to I'm much older than you guys. And mum, you know, with the next generation above from me, all her friends as well said, you're kidding, you're actually going to go and do this? I mean, you know, we might go on a short trip, but, you know, what about your doctor? What about if anything happens? What about, you know, there's all these reasons not to do things in this life at all times, right? But especially for women, and especially, you know, for women who have got this burden of caring in our lives. So, you know, one of the things that mum had to do as part, like it was very, very arduous to actually get the residency permit. You know, we had to go down to the Greek embassy in Sydney, we live in Brisbane, to in person because you couldn't do it online. Mum had to do all these medical tests, including a syphilis test. So I thought that she would have had, you know, I just thought her doctor would just sign off on it, you know, like it would just be, all, you know, okay, she's not going to have syphilis, you know, tick. No, she actually had to go and do the blood test. So, you know, it was very, very arduous to actually go through all these hoops to actually get there. And at any point, she could have said, oh, you know, I think this is a bit too much, but she didn't. And I think she was so brave and so you know, gutsy, really, to actually want to do something like that and actually do it. So I say to all of you, you know, no matter how old you are, I remember I read on a... I've lived in a lot of places, but I lived in France once and I was going over from England on the ferry, and there was an expatriate newspaper for English expatriates, as it was, and it was telling the story of this 99-year-old Scottish woman who all her life had wanted to live in France, and she said, I'm at the end of my life, I'm going to do it. 99. So, you know, obviously health is something that we'll talk about later. Health issues are, and I've had health issues, all three of us have had various health issues, and I just want to say to Tracy as well, you know, Tracy's had long COVID, and today, you know, I think it's wonderful that you're actually here to do this gig, so, you know, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've touched on something there that is a real common experience of women, that we start with caring for children, if we have children or the young people in our lives. Then we care for elderly parents. And where is the right time to do something for us? Another thread that runs through both of your books and a lot of our experiences for the women here in the audience, the relentlessness of the sexual harassment and assault throughout our lives. Jacinta, you speak about that a lot at the start of your book and that really vexed feeling when you're growing up of the catcalling. Mm. Can you drill into that a bit for us?
Yeah, I think when I was writing this book, it began kind of with that kind of light reflection on what it feels like to age and to be treated differently on the outside than how we feel on the inside. But when I started to drill into, but there's also this really, sorry, whoever's looking for this lady over here, she's here. Whoever, what? Will you please go to her? There she is. Did you find her? Round of applause. That's what we call, you know, love amongst women. But when we really look at and we drill down into some of the experiences of rage that we feel, often it's kind of palmed off to being hormonal. You know, we're cross because we're menopausal. But when you go back and you look at the origins of the experience of being a woman and a young girl in this society, you realise just how deeply objectified we are. And doing the research into this book, the most common age that catcalling begins on the street is at 11 years of age. So an 11-year-old girl suddenly transforms from being a little girl into understanding somehow this intuition around, oh, I'm desired. They might not even be the words or the concepts that we have at that age, but we begin to understand that we have value, in inverted commas, for that aspect of our humanity. And so deeply that is built into us from such an early age that it almost, and there's almost comedy, I think, that's shared amongst women when it stops happening. You're like, oh, what is wrong with me now? But how deeply problematic it all is, in that that is how we are viewed, that is how we are valued, that is our experience of the world, and then when it's gone, have we lost our value? And some of that rage that comes through is around, what have I been for this time? Am I just the carer, the nurturer, the mother, the slut? Sorry to use the terminology, but it really is how we are very much dynamically experiencing the world. And so I just felt like it was really important not to see aging as this siloed thing that happens later on. It's happening to us, inside us, from a very, very young age as to how we emerge into this older being that has had the experience of being a woman in this Western world.
And we hold that within us as we age.
Yes.
That idea of beauty as currency. And therefore, aging is more difficult for women than it is for men, for that reason, one of many reasons. Susan, you write about what I wrote my first book about, which is the good girl syndrome, that at times when you were groped and grabbed, you internalised it. And even when it happened when you were older. And, you know, why does this keep happening to us and why do we keep internalising it?
Well, I'm very ashamed to say I was 62 when I got groped on the... This is exactly how it happens. I'm a second-wave feminist. I mean, I went on, you know, Reclaim the Night marches. I did all that. I mean, I know what I'm supposed to do, right? You know, and here I was at the age of 62 on a balcony one night at a dinner in Greece when I was living on the island, and this guy at the table was sort of, or you know, like kind of under the table like this, and you know, like around my back, and started off with, you know, sort of rubbing my back and, you know, doing this, and I can't believe I, for a start, he was Greek and it was at a Greek, so I was very conscious of, you know, being a non-Greek at this thing. But he was a Greek Englishman. He wasn't, you know, a local person. He was visiting. So, you know, and I didn't want to embarrass my friends who were hosting it. This good girl stuff just came straight in. And I just tittered. And, you know, I really made a complete ass of myself. I couldn't believe it. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, you know, that those feelings of waking up in the middle of the night and you think, oh my God, I just want to die. I just want to go into a, you know, I'll crawl into a hole. I could not believe I acted like that because it's so deeply ingrained in us. Even now, I would have thought I would have just slapped his hand away if you said to me here. I mean, I feel an idiot even telling this story because you just don't know how this happens, but it is so, so deeply ingrained. But in fact, what I did, because I went over the whole thing, and in fact, the next morning he sent me a photograph of myself of that night, and I thought, well, this is a record of the last night, my last night on earth as a woman who's going to respond like that. So the next time I saw him, I pulled myself up to my full height. I said to him, "Hello, Nick." And every time I saw him subsequently, at every social event, I said, I was talking about myself in my writerly self, because he actually is in London and he has a he runs a sort of talent agency. So I just spoke to him as a very esteemed Australian author. Yes? And it worked. He actually started, you know, and I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to do this. I'm not going to smile. I'm not going to titter, which is what I normally do. And this is what, you know, it's so ingrained. And it actually gave me some gravitas. And I realised that when you're a young woman, you don't have gravitas. You're robbed of that. Your body is public. And, you know, I'm sure we're of a generation where we've all got stories of when drinking and newspaper culture, everyone got drunk and, you know, being filled up, or, you know, jokes about you were just common. And we didn't do any, you know, the things that happened to us when we were young women, we had no right of reply. So thank God for Me Too and this movement now. But here, what I'm saying to you is it's very, very difficult to eradicate it.
You're right. So many of us were surrounded by this wallpaper of misogyny. It became normalised to be groped and grabbed. And I love that at a certain age, you did get the confidence to put on that cloak, to put on that armour, to hold yourself up as your writerly professional self, to be able to withstand it. One of those cloaks that we do put on as we get older, and society does support this, is the cloak of invisibility. And you both write about this. Jacinta, the trans advocate Eves Reese said to you that invisibility is actually a privilege. How do you feel about it as you get older?
Oh, man, I am starting to roll around in it in enormous joy, because there is this, from suddenly this place of feeling objectified and you know, certainly not like, wow, like, oh, who, you know, feeling judged constantly, to not being seen in places is, and I guess there's so many dimensions to this. For me as a white, very privileged woman, I find it a wonderful experience to be, you know, become not noticed in spaces. But also, you make a really good point, Tracy, to highlight the fact that invisibility is a privilege as well. There are women in our intersections of class and colour and sexuality and gender that don't have the same experience of invisibility, and still there is an enormous amount of reaction and objectification and judgment and discrimination. So there's a real double-edged sword when we think about it in terms of through the different frames that we live. But it is, for me, and it's a really interesting reflection on how we can go back inside when that objectification starts to cease, and when you start to regard yourself in a hopeful way of the learning through life in perhaps a different way, to start narrating the external life differently than what I had been doing my whole life. Taking that gaze away helps to come back in and to start listening to what it is that I am. Who am I really, without all that pressure of expectation that sits around us for such a long time? And of course the expectation continues, and the way we are seen is diminished as we age. But there is a moment of escape, I think, that allows for this reflection and owning of self in a way that is very hard when we're younger.
Mm. It's lovely to come within by acknowledging that, and also as writers and journalists and observers, it gives us a superpower. The number of times that I've sat in cafes
being invisible and just eavesdropped on people's conversations and they don't even notice that you're there. So I quite like that superpower. How do you feel about invisibility, Susan?
Well, I've got a kind of interesting take on it because my mother was... the older she got, the more she sort of stood out in a way because she and I... We had and this is a generational thing. My mother was a model when she was young. I've got Dad's crooked teeth, which had very white, straight teeth, and she used to do toothpaste ads where they'd black out her teeth, you know, sort of before and after things. She was very arrestingly beautiful. And as she got older, as women get older, they cut their hair. Mum went the other way. She grew her hair long and she used to sweep it up in this amazing French roll that I don't know how she did it, but she would, you know, so she was never invisible. And what Mum looked like was a very important part of her identity. So we went to war quite a lot as I was growing up, and especially when I didn't shave my legs and things like that. You know, she was horrified by, and I, you know, I went through a whole, you know, Butch Dyke look, you know, of got like my hair buzz cut and, you know, and Mum hated it. And really, so we had a sort of a generational divide where for Mum, right up until the day she died, what she looked like was very, very important. And I think for that generation of women, and Mum wasn't invisible. She truly was not. I would walk down the street with her because she had this beautiful silver roll. People, like on the island, she became known as the supermodel because she had this incredible roll. So it's kind of interesting for me. I know it's a serious question, and it is a serious question about invisibility, and it used to really bug me that you know, because Mum wouldn't address it in any serious way. But that's because she's a different generation and, you know, you can't impose, you know, she's the same age as Gloria Steinem. So there are other women who went down a different path, and there'll be many women here of that age. Mum was born in 1933. But it is an interesting question. It's invisibility for me, I find it is a great joy as well because of that thing of being able to know who you are besides your physical appearance. It's incredibly liberating, I think.
I agree. And yet we must talk about physical appearance because it is a shock when you wake up one day and you find a 2-inch hair coming out of your chin that wasn't there the day beforehand and you only see it when you're driving in the car and you've just parked, you know, when the light comes in at an angle. And who else keeps tweezers in their car for that reason? It is just the best thing ever.
Tracy, I had a doctor once reach over to my face and try and rub something off and I go, no, that's attached. That's my long black hair that grows out the side of my face that I'm very attached to.
That is hilarious. And the other things you don't expect, no one tells you your knees are going to sag, right? Jacinta, in your book you talk about the tuck shop arms, and when I first got them, the kids were younger, of course, and I used to wave them around with great joy to make them laugh and say, jelly on a plate, jelly on a plate. So how do you feel about those physical things? I mean, we're told not to care about that, but because we've internalised this beauty myth, of course we do.
Of course we do, and I think it's coming to that stage now of recognising that we are going through all of these massive pressures on us. Not only are we subjected to the criticism and the objectification, but we've also got to solve the problem and feel fantastic about it. When really, at the end of the day, it's a whole different solution, I think, that needs to happen. Mm. I remember, and we talk about the tuck shop arms, you know, the beautiful women that would come in and serve us food and their arms would wobble around. And when I first saw mine one day out the corner of my eye, I was like, oh, it's arrived, you know. I am part of this, you know, sacred group. But I think it is a disservice to start, especially as, you know, the sisterhood, as women across the generations, I think what we do fail at is allowing each other to experience and express and explore this external self in the way that feels good. We've got so many rules around, well, you shouldn't do this and you should do that and you shouldn't do your face and you should do your face and you shouldn't do your hair. Really, at the end of the day, I think it's reckoning with the fact we've come through this world. We're just working out now how to really celebrate the experience. Let's be kind to each other. Mm. Let's look at our young women with the kind eyes that we wish looked upon ourselves. Let's not judge them for the choices that they make around how they externalize experience. Mm. Mm. Thank you. But yeah, that it is, that I think that's got to come later in our concerns. Mm.
Mm. And there's also a cultural aspect to it, isn't there? You write, Susan, that in Europe, women of all shapes, sizes and ages go down to the beach in bikinis. What did you discover about the cultural differences, and why don't we do that in Australia?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm sure you've all seen in Greece, Italy, France, women of all shapes and sizes and ages in little string bikinis, you know. It's a wonderful thing to see. Like, you know, Australia is got this terrible beach culture. Are you beach ready, beach body ready, and all that sort of, you know, where you're supposed to have this body of a 25-year-old, you know, when you're sort of 70. I never forgot, I've got a very good friend who's actually now got dementia and she's in a nursing home in Paris. She, when I was a young woman, when I first met Simone, I was about 30, it was, and she would have been about my age. And we went to the beach and I had I don't think I had a one piece, but I think I had a, you know, certainly my bikini was much bigger than hers. She had like a string bikini. And I remember being so taken aback that she was going to go and parade us off at that age, you know, and I thought she was very old, obviously. But, you know, you as you get older, I still wear a bikini, and I've had quite a lot of surgery because I had birth trauma when I gave birth to my children, and I ended up with a temporary colostomy for 19 months.
With so colostomy got, bag friends.
Yeah, we've just been talking about this because Jacinta also had one because of Crohn's disease. I had one because of birth trauma, both temporary and reverse. So I've got quite a scarred belly, and I've given birth, so I've got the children's belly. And, you know, I still wear a bikini. I love to wear a bikini. And my mother, now this is the thing about appearance. So I went to the beach the first time on the island, and my mother said, Susan, you know, you've got no idea. It looks really awful with your belly hanging, flopping out like that. It looks really bad. And I, you know, so there's another thing. Like mum was, you know, mothers and daughters about, you know, bodies and shaming and, you know, what. I mean, it was so, and I didn't care. I really don't care. And you know, I still get out, you know, in my bikini. So, and I think that's what we've got to do: age disgracefully and not care. We don't, you know, really. We've got to lose that thing about, you know, whether we're beach body or, you know, ready or whatever, and just go and let it all hang out. That's what I think.
A round of applause and a big woohoo to that one. I wanted explore a bit more deeply this concept of living disgracefully and growing old gracefully. What does it even mean, Jacinta? What does it even mean?
I think it's a really interesting thing that we need to talk about more broadly and more, and as you say, Tracy, get into the depth of it. But at its very kind of face, I think it is about a really conscious effort, and it's personal. I think it can't be done in this kind of, we all feel this way. I think your punk, you know, your self that feels like it is asserting itself against that really dominant kind of sense of what you've grown up believing about yourself, that reclaiming, I think, is a beautiful form of disgrace, you know, that we're not doing it in the way that we are acceptable, but acceptable to us. The grace of love of self, I think, is one of the most enormously transformative things. And you know, due to the systems and all the blah, blah, it's very hard to find yourself necessarily there in this context. So I think disgrace is a beautiful thing to aspire to, but it's personal and it's about affirmation. And I think, I think it's a wonderful thing to be talking about.
Mm. Oh, aspiring to live disgracefully. That is a wonderful key message from today. About 6 years ago, I learnt to play the electric guitar. I'd always played the acoustic, but I just love that feeling of claiming that, you know, that traditionally really sort of big penis masculine space of punk rock stars on stage with a big phallic guitar. I just freaking loved claiming that as an older woman, you know. How do you view this idea of living disgracefully?
Well, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, as you said. I think that women are often shamed in many, many ways, and it's very easy for a woman to feel disgraced, more especially for women, I would argue, than men. So I think it's something that you have to really be conscious of and try to address, a way to live in a way that you want to, regardless of how other people are going to see it. So I don't necessarily think it means, you know, walking down the street with no clothes on. I just think it means whatever fits for you, you know, whichever way that you can somehow find a life that fits with living responsibly and being, you know, like, you know, I'm not saying you do whatever you want and tread over everybody else, but try and live, you know, how you want to live, but be responsible at the same time to you know, your community. But so for me, it's just living how you want to and regard and blocking out that sense of shame and disgrace that women live with all the time in one way or another.
Yeah, that's a really great way to push back. I love that. And yet when we're trying to reclaim our power, sometimes our bodies work against us in different ways. Susan, I'm going to stay with you on this one, and before we talk about chronic illness, I want to ask about menopause, because I sort of started to feel like I was getting more powerful, and then perimenopause and menopause came along and kind of knocked me flat in a way. How do you feel about that?
No, I'm unfortunately, I come from generations of women who've had no problems with menopause, and in fact my grandfather's mother gave birth to him when she was 52. And I know that sounds unbelievable, but we do have his birth certificate does show that she was so embarrassed, and a gynecologist tried to tell me that couldn't have been true. But I actually know some other Filipino women who've also had, and it actually is true, because his older brother was 24. She didn't go out for the whole of the pregnancy because she was so ashamed. And so basically he was neglected and, you know, but he left school, he finished schooling, this is in the country, when he was about 10. So I come from this whole line. I've got another friend who got pregnant accidentally when she was 48. I had no problem. I had my children very late. I had my last son when I was 40, after my 40th birthday. And so for me, menopause was something that I just sort of went through without noticing. And I have had a lot of friends who've had completely other issues. So for me, it wasn't necessarily an issue. So I think I'm just, you know, I was blessed with that, because I do know it can be. I mean, my best friend said, for her to describe hot flushes, she said it's like being in a sauna wrapped in cling film. That's how she, you know, but I was just very lucky. So for me, it wasn't an issue, but oh, you're too young.
No, I'm not. Right,
there we go.
I'm really old. No, I'm definitely in the peri stage, yeah, of it all. And yeah, it's a really, it's a confronting thing as well, I think. The end of something, you know, that we've for long felt shame about, and then all of a sudden I felt like I haven't embraced it in the way that perhaps I may have my menstrual cycle, you know. But yeah, I mean, I guess it aligns as well with that body stuff that you wanted to talk about with chronic illness as well and aging.
Yes. How has your chronic illness impacted your view of aging? I imagine you had an insight into your body working against you from a much younger age.
I think part of the aging experience is obviously that kind of duality between the spirit and the physical capacity. And so with chronic illness, I had a very confronting experience with a changed body that I wasn't expecting. And so, you know, about a decade of really serious illness that had me bedridden and in pain for quite a period of that time. And so in that period, I feel like I have done some of the business that is of an aging body's experience, to really look in and think, gosh, I can't do the things my spirit wants to do. I can't walk, I can't run, I can't participate in the world. Who am I as a result of that? But also the really confronting questions around mortality that I know become present when we see friends dying and we begin to age in a way that we have to face the experience of these bodies at some point dying. And so I feel like I've had a little peekaboo into that experience of aging through the body and what it does and how it, the experience of it is. And I think I've come to I've had very deep experiences of trying to understand and reconcile it. And I do know that it is also a tremendous gift to be confronted with the true questions of our life through the confrontation of our death and our fragility. I do know that now I live with that in my heart, but not as fear anymore as I once did, more as a sense of purpose and release, I suppose, a real clarity of existence.
And a sense of understanding as well. That really comes across in your book. This part of the conversation might be a bit confronting for those of you who live with any kind of illness, chronic illness, invisible illness. And I just want you to know that this is a very safe space, and I hope it's not too distressing for you, but it is a very important thing to talk about. Susan, towards the end of your book, you write about when your mother passed away and you were diagnosed with a malignant tumour, and you write, "And I wondered if I was allowed to be alive when she was dead." You write about how this affects the way in which we age, the struggles we face. And I started thinking about, you know, writing while in ill health and confronting when you were diagnosed with the tumour. Are you okay to talk about that?
Yeah. It was bowel cancer, and I was successfully treated. You know, there wasn't any spread to the lymph nodes or whatever. But, you know, you have a touch. You are brushed by the wing of death. You know, you definitely know. And also coming, following Mum's death, it was very, very painful, terrible period. Look, I didn't write during that period, and my lovely publisher is here, Annette, and Annette will know. She was very generously gave me extra time to deliver the manuscript, because at one stage I thought, well, I won't be able to write it at all, because it derailed, as you might imagine, entirely a story that started off one thing and ended up another. I couldn't write during the actual experience of it, so it was really only afterwards. And thank goodness I had about extensive notebooks. I had about 9 or 10 notebooks that I'd kept during the whole of our period in Greece. And I just think it made the work, the finished work, a different book than it would have been. And I think a sort of a more somber book in many ways, because it is really about our experience of life, the choices we make, how do we spend our wild and precious years on this earth? You know, what do we do? And it was very confronting, and I think it, it made it a different book.
Yeah, it's very moving towards the end, and actually quite a shock when you write about that, because it makes us confront our own mortality. One thing that is really problematic about white culture is that we become elderly. We don't become elders. We don't celebrate being elders. And Jacinta, you write about this in the book. How can we change that?
I had a beautiful experience. Uncle Jack Charles, who's one of the great characters of this country, but especially in Melbourne, where you would see him on his little three-wheeler bike chuffing around the city, he would come in and visit me on my radio show that I do on the ABC, and he was awarded the NAIDOC Elder of the Year, as was Dr. Lois Peeler, who was also a friend and someone who would join me on the show. And both of them reflect in eldership in such a way that so profoundly moved me. In one of the last chats I had with him on air, he spoke about eldership, and he, glowing with the pride of being an elder, very, very different perspective of what it is to be shamed about growing old, but also that there was this beautiful two-way exchange that he understood. Eldership was about loving and bringing and nurturing, but it was also about that experience of being loved and nurtured. So this, not this barrier that we experience, as you say, in white culture often around the old people and the young people, and maybe they meet somewhere, just a terribly important kind of flow within each other. And such important learnings as we can from our First Nations communities every single day of our lives in every single way, but just about the different way that the word elder is, that one little letter from older to elder changes the nature of it, and it makes it about community and it makes it about family and love. And I just think it's so powerful, and it stayed with me deeply.
How can we explain that to our teenage daughters? I've got a teenage daughter, and boy, they push back against older women, don't they?
Just in response to that, because I am going through that experience right now, and if anyone would like to counsel me on having a 19-year-old daughter who is deeply troubled by my existence, I'd love to hear from you. But I think what really came to me at the end of this book in writing it was that eldership is about holding that space. It's not about telling. It's not about knowing. It's not about being the one who has all the wisdom. It's about this experience of space holding and allowing the new shoots to come through and to do what they've got to do. They've got to push. They've got to pull. We know this. But it's the grace in that. It's the knowing where we stand and the allowance of the beautiful experience of the two-way exchange. It's not wisdom coming down. It's wisdom being shared through the understanding of each other's spaces. So while I am not necessarily practicing what I'm preaching right now as I breathe deeply through her things. She's not here, thank goodness. Don't tell her that I'm talking about her. I do feel so strongly about the time we need to break silos down between each other. We need to have our teenagers living with us, feeling us, doing the things with us right through the generations and right back and forward.
Mm. Susan, you're only 66. Do you feel like you're an elder at this stage or not?
That's an interesting question. I think now that I'm the next generation in line, now that Mum's passed away, I think I do now, and I would very much like to experience it as First Nations people do, in the sense of all the other things that come with being an elder, the respect that comes with elders that I don't think we have so much in our culture. Yes, I do definitely feel. I think the last couple of years have moved me into another phase of life. I now know I'm in the last phase of my life, much more. You'll notice this when you in the next 10 years, really, when I said to my best friend Emma the other day that we'll be 80 in 13 years, and she said, oh, no, that you got the maths wrong. And then she said, she's the same age as me. She was born the same in 1956. Oh, my God. She just could not believe that we're going to be 80 in 13 years. So I'd already, the difference is she's never really had any illness. And so I think that I have now definitely passed into another phase of life. I'm definitely in the elder phase of life.
When you look back on your rich life with so many different experiences, what do you regret and what do you cherish?
I try not to regret because, you know, you can't undo things, sadly, in this life. I mean, there are many, many things I wish I could undo. The things I cherish are my sons, my family and my community, you know, the people who love me and who I love. I cherish the fact that I'm alive and that I have the great gift of being alive. You know, there were moments when in my life in the past where I haven't really respected my life as much as I should have. And so I think that is a different stage of being old. You do.
What do you mean by that you didn't respect your life at those times?
I think, you know, I mean, without going into an hour's.
Well, let's go. I mean, I'd like to know, Susan. Yeah.
No. I mean, no, I think that, you know, I think it took me a long time to get the sort of self-respect, I think. I mean, I had difficult parents, and I think a lot of people do. And I think that, you know, it took me, you know, quite a long time to come to that realization. And like, for example, me speaking to this numbers of people, when I realised when I was publishing a book, my first book was in 1987, that I also would have to speak to people about it, I thought, well, I just can't do it. I can't do public speaking. I can't do it. So I had to go to this WEA class. I was living in Sydney then. Workers' Education Authority used to run these public speaking courses. There were all these people, for various reasons, who were terrified of public speaking. One, it was during the AIDS crisis. So this woman was an Australian specialist who had to go and speak to 2,000 leading scientists in Paris at the AIDS conference, and she said, I can't do it. There was a guy who couldn't get promoted at work because he couldn't do speak in public and do, meetings and everything. And me, because I thought, so there were other people. So I think, I think when I feel down on myself, I think, well, I've actually done quite a lot to even get up and speak. So there's little things that I will look at and I think, oh, well, that's not too bad. Now I will be proud of myself for things, which has taken me a long time to get to that point. That's all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for being so vulnerable and candid about that. What do you regret and what do you cherish?
It's such a beautiful question because I think we do have those wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and wish we had said something to the Greek guy who felt us up under the table.
Yeah.
But I actually now am beginning to cherish my regrets. I think that what I'm realising is that I'm not to be afraid of the challenge or the things I've got wrong, because that's where the richness is, you know. I know it's kind of a glib comment, but I have really started to embody not being afraid anymore of when it doesn't go well. Having had enough experiences, I think, where, oh, God, you know, being sick has been the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life, because it taught me so much. Mm. You cannot know for which way the world will take you. And so I guess it is about reflecting in this bigger picture rather than in the microcosm. I'm going on a journey. I can't believe I said it, Tracy. I said the word journey. But I'm going on a pathway. And I'm just learning how to not be afraid of all the dimensions of it.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I love that sense of cherishing what we regret. That's got a deep wisdom to it. Mm. And also of viewing our illnesses as a gift. I've had long COVID for a year and a half now, and last year I was either in bed or in a wheelchair, and I view the wheelchair as a great gift because it gave me mobility. I was able to actually get out of the house, even though I was in the house pretty much permanently for about 6 months. But it also gave me an insight into what it might be like living older with illness as well. Mm. And learning that and having a glimpse of it, I think, is a gift for life. We're coming close to the end of the session, I'm sad to say, because you're both so wise and clever and beautiful souls. I could talk to you all day. But what is one thing that you would like this magnificent audience to be left with? What's one message you'd like them to remember from this session?
Susan looks to me. Smart, smart Susan. I think the thing that I left in the writing of this book has really stayed with me, and I've kind of mentioned it already, but I think that what we haven't got quite right in all the waves of feminism is loving and having that wide space for our experiences together. I especially feel like it generationally, we need to kindly look upon the way that the world has made it for us to do what we need to do. And with our youngsters, with our little ones coming through, that it's so important, this collective idea of us, that we aren't just older and younger, that we're a continuum, that we exist on this long expanse of time. And it makes me feel such strong feelings to think of us this way and to love us this way, you know, and that deep love that I think we can feel for ourselves when we love up and we love down, you know, when we see the beautiful tuck shop arms and we celebrate them in others is our loving of ourselves and vice versa. So I don't know, you know, I don't know anything, but I do feel like this meditation has been wonderful for that outcome. Mm. Mm.
Yeah, how would we sum it up? I do think there's a wonderful energy when you have this many women in the room.
And that women come out to listen and to think and to talk with each other
absolutely.
Is just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, so I would just say, you know, we are all, there's no us up here and you down there. It's really, you know, we're all in this thing together that and we're, as Jacinta and I were walking up, I just said, you know, why is life so hard about something? You know, like it's hard, the struggle is there, but let's struggle through together. And communally, I think women are amazing. So all I would say is, you know, thank you to all you and thank you to Jacinta and to Tracy. And that my message is go forth and keep doing what you're doing. I thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Can I say too, before you do your fancy wrap up, what an incredible human Tracy Spicer
yes.
is.
You're here. Yeah.
Just how thoughtful and deep, and the way that you're able to do what you do. I just wanted to acknowledge that here.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And so much for women. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's lovely. I'm really touched by those words. Look, thank you all so much for coming out. We would love you to buy both of these books, Aphrodite's Breath.
I bought it and I
and
don't
A Question
regret
of Age. Our wonderful authors will be signing them straight after, but thank you for coming out. Once again, please thank Susan Johnson and Jacinta Parsons.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.